Hello, Vancouver. Welcome to the Local Brown Bagger, heard every Tuesday on CFRO, Radio 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, BC. Why are Canadian troops in Afghanistan? Is it for introducing democracy and undertaking reconstruction, as the politicians claim from the major parties, or is there another agenda? John Foster, energy economist, spoke at the Maritime Labor Center on September 16, 2008. He was a guest of the Vancouver and District Labor Council as part of their monthly educational sessions. He spoke about historical rivalries among major world powers in this area and the present-day role that Afghanistan plays in the struggle to control the energy market and gas pipelines that are currently being played out in Central Asia. This is what the VDLC said about their guest speaker. John Foster is an international energy economist and an expert on the world oil scene. He has a unique combination of work experience with two oil companies, British Petroleum and Petro-Canada, and two international banks, the World Bank and the Inter-American Developmental Bank. All of his work has been in the fields of energy and international development. He and his wife Millie live in Kingston, Ontario. John will tell us about plans for Afghanistan to become an energy bridge, a pipeline corridor for natural gas from Central to South Asia via Kandahar. In June, the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives published his research paper titled Pipeline in a Troubled Land. This paper garnered major headlines in the Globe and Mail when it was released in June, though we don't hear it being discussed much by the major parties during the present election campaign. The moderator of the educational session was Bill Saunders of the Vancouver and District Labor Council.
It's good to see a good turnout for an educational. I think we have an important one. We're very, very pleased to have with us tonight an excellent presenter. He's done some research for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and they published his paper on Afghanistan and Central Asia. I forget the title of the paper when it was published.
Pipeline Through a Troubled Land.
But tonight we're going to talk a bit about that region and about how energy distribution plays out with a particular focus on Afghanistan. It's Afghanistan and the Central Asian energy game. This is pretty topical, as I guess you all realize now, not only because Canada has troops in Afghanistan, it obviously makes it an important issue for us to understand what the dynamics are in that country, but also recent events has shown us that in Georgia, where Russia invaded, and then later the analysis comes out, obviously, that there's three pipelines that run through that country, and control of that energy distribution is very strategic to global politics. So a lot of this stuff is linked together. It plays out in a certain kind of way. It often isn't reported on in the paper, except, I guess, when they're critiquing the Soviet Union's actions and how they're trying to control the energy distribution. But I think John's going to help us out to understand that tonight. So, John Foster.
I want to thank Bill for your kind words, and I'll give thanks to the VDLC for inviting me to speak, and to you, the audience, for coming. Thanks also to the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, CCPA, for helping me get these ideas out, and to your BC office for helping promote this event. I'm delighted to be here, and I do appreciate this opportunity to talk about Afghanistan. So, a couple of things. That's the question that I started with. Why has Afghanistan become the major focus of Canadian defense aid and foreign policy? I spent my life doing international work, and I'm familiar with Asia for many years, but yet that question puzzled me. Now, I'm an energy economist, and that's me there thinking. And in my work life at the World Bank, I travel to countries such as Iran, Indonesia, Venezuela, to understand the oil and gas sectors of their economy. And at Petro-Canada, I would dig away at the world oil scene, figuring out how it all fitted together. And over the past year, I've been doing the same kind of digging, looking at Afghanistan in its regional setting. In their book, The Unexpected War, Canada in Kandahar, Stein and Lang, Janice Stein, Eugene Lang, say, Canada went to Afghanistan to placate the Americans, and that our leaders knew little of Afghan tribal divisions or the history of expelling foreign armies. So that raises the question, what is the US motivation? We need to take it to that point. And the United States has its own geopolitical strategies in Asia. Richard Boucher, and I'll come back to him more than once, is an interesting guy. He's the US Assistant Secretary of State for South and Central Asia. And he says, one of our goals is to stabilize Afghanistan, to link South and Central Asia together so that energy can flow to the South. So that's a major goal. Now, tonight, I'd like first to focus on Afghanistan as an energy bridge, and I'll explain what I mean by that. And I'll then address the big picture, the new great game in Central Asia and Western control of the Middle East. And finally, I'll talk about Canada, Afghanistan, and the energy connection between the two. Now, here's a map of Afghanistan. Its position between Central Asia to the north and Central and South Asia, Pakistan and India, make it a link between the two, a bridge. But who are its northern neighbors? Typically where our geography lessons run out. And there it borders three of the five countries that became independent upon the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991. And note Turkmenistan especially is immediate neighbor of Afghanistan to the northwest. Turkmenistan has enormous reserves of natural gas. I'll come back to that. And Afghanistan offers a route for export to the south by pipeline. When the Taliban ran Afghanistan, two consortia vied for the right to build a pipeline, one led by Unocal, an American company, and the other by Bridas, an Argentinian company. And not surprisingly, the US government supported Unocal. The US government, was negotiating on and off with the Taliban regime during both the Clinton and the Bush II administrations. And the Bush administration saw the Taliban as a source of stability for the proposed pipeline. Negotiations finally broke down in August of 2001. And shortly after, as you know, the US ousted the Taliban with the help of the northern tribes. Our government makes much of Afghanistan being a democracy, but it has to be said that Karzai was handpicked by the United States as an interim president, as the interim president, and the Afghan election in 2004 had many irregularities. In that election, only a few minor candidates represented the Pashtun tribes in the south, roughly 40% of the population. So, where do the Pashtun live? First, a word about Kandahar. It's one of the major cities of the Pashtun people. There are well over 30 million Pashtun people, and that's shown in green on this map. And Pashtun live both sides of the Afghan Pakistan border, which is shown in black on that map, and we hear about that border in our news. But it's an artificial border, the so-called Durand Line, imposed by British India in 1893, and it was drawn intentionally to break up the Pashtun tribes, divide and rule. In fact, local tribes' people move freely backwards and forwards. Pashtun and Kandahar have been independent from Kabul for ages, and those in Pakistan are relatively independent of Islamabad. Now, here's the route of the proposed pipeline, and if anybody have a copy of the paper, you'll see it there too. Planning of that pipeline barely paused for the invasion. In 2002, Interim President Karzai signed a memorandum of understanding with the presidents of Pakistan and Turkmenistan. The pipeline project is well documented in the Asian press. It's called TAPI, after the initials of the four participating countries, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. And the route would pass right through Kandahar and the tribal areas of Pakistan, so much in our news. The pipeline was documented at two major donor conferences on Afghanistan in 2006 and this June. Countries promised to help Afghanistan become an energy bridge. They used that phrase, energy bridge. And Canada attended both conferences at high level, in fact at ministerial level. Realistic or not, construction is planned to start in 2010, just 2 years from now, and of course Canadian forces are committed to 2011, December. Yet, despite all that, until this summer, almost no one in Canada talked about the pipeline. Yet, if it goes ahead, it could be Afghanistan's largest development project, and transit revenues could contribute about one-third of domestic revenue of the government, and it could pay for teachers, infrastructure, and all that. Despite their concerns for pipeline security, the four participating countries met this April to sign what they call a framework agreement. The Asian Development Bank is helping develop the project. And the project is estimated to cost about $7.6 billion. And Afghanistan says the route will be cleared of landmines and Taliban within 2 years. Meanwhile, Iran has offered an alternative to the route through Afghanistan, a pipeline to supply Iranian gas to Pakistan and India. It would cost about the same amount of money. And the route would avoid strife-torn Afghanistan altogether. Russia's Gazprom, and that's the world's largest gas company, says it's willing to help build the line, and BP, British Petroleum, has expressed interest. But the United States is squeezing India and Pakistan to abandon the project and go for the line through Afghanistan. So, that's my first point. In a regional setting, Afghanistan is an energy bridge. It's much else besides, but that's how it's seen by countries at high level. And now, I'll talk about the big picture, energy security and the new great game. Energy has become a major issue at NATO. It came up at the NATO summits in Bucharest this April and in Riga 2006. The United States has made several proposals to commit NATO to energy security activities. It wants to get other NATO countries involved. The summits reached no decision, but these proposals haven't gone away. So let's look at one of them. One proposal calls for NATO to guard pipelines and sea lanes. So What would that mean to the Gafgan pipeline? Would it apply to that? And if so, NATO troops could be in Afghanistan an awful long time. Pipelines last until they're decommissioned, and that can be 50 years or more. Would our Navy be part of an oil protection service in the Persian Gulf or worldwide? Can you see that at the back? There's a lot of writing. But in Europe last year, Prime Minister Harper said, energy security requires unprecedented international cooperation. Protecting and maintaining the world's energy supply system. Has he already signed on to the NATO proposals? They could have enormous consequences for Canada, especially if NATO's role is extended to include energy security worldwide. Energy security is a euphemism for the new great game in Central Asia. It's a geopolitical game among the world's great powers for control of energy resources. And this game is openly analyzed in US think tanks, such as the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. It's well reported in the Asian press. It's hardly visible in Canada, and that's why I'm talking about it. The term great game dates back to the 19th century. It was popularized in Rudyard Kipling's novels. That great game was about the rivalry between the British and the Russian empires in Asia. The epicenter was Afghanistan, where the British fought and lost three wars. Throughout history, tribal loyalty in Afghanistan has trumped all, making life difficult for invaders. The Soviets came and went, and now NATO is there. So a bit of geography coming up. North of Afghanistan are the four, five countries of Central Asia. They're sandwiched between the Caspian Sea to the west, Russia to the north, China to the east, and Iran and Afghanistan to the south. Kazakhstan in green is by far the largest Central Asian country. It's huge, about the same size as Western Canada, including Manitoba. And it has the largest oil reserves in Central Asia. They're said to be about three times the size of the North Sea. Turkmenistan in pink, down on the, may have the world's fourth largest reserves of natural gas. They say it might be the third. And that makes it bigger than Canada. Both these countries border the Caspian Sea, and so does Azerbaijan, which is shown in orange. Also Iran and Russia, all producers of oil and gas. So the Caspian is the world's largest inland body of water. It's about 20 times the size of Lake Ontario. The Central Asian countries became independent in 1991 when the Soviet Union broke up. Until then, their oil and gas flowed only to the north through Soviet pipelines, then in part to Europe. But after 1991, rival world powers began to explore ways to help tap these reserves and move them in other directions. And that was the start of the new great game. And you can be sure Dick Cheney understands it. And Ottawa has gone along with Washington. The new great game is among countries who want energy to flow in directions under their control. North to Russia, west to Europe, east to China, and south through Afghanistan. And who are the players? The United States, China, Russia, regional powers such as India, Pakistan, Iran and Turkey, NATO countries, and by extension, Canada, through its NATO membership. The Caspian countries are far from the world's oceans and tankers, so they must rely on pipelines. Now, you may think that pipelines are boring, but I'm an energy economist and I find them fascinating, and I'm going to tell you about them. Pipelines are important today in the same way that railways, the railway building, was important in the 19th century. They connect trading partners, and they influence the regional balance of power. And the pipeline route is critical. The oil or the gas can only go where the pipeline goes. Here's a map showing some of the pipeline routes moving north, south, east, and west from the Caspian region. From Turkmenistan, shown in green, a new gas pipeline is being built east to China, and a new oil pipeline has been built from central Kazakhstan, also to China. And this map shows gas routes from central Asia to Europe, solid in red. Turkmenistan exports virtually all its gas Kazakhstan to Russia, and construction began this summer on a new gas line to the north. And when the project was announced, the US Energy Secretary, Samuel Bodman, said the project was not good for Europe. His thoughtfulness for Europe I found quite striking. Russia's new president, Medvedev, said visited leaders in the region soon after he came to power, came to office. He was previously, chairman of Gazprom, the world's largest gas company. There's something about presidents, isn't it, that makes you think they have to have been with gas, oil before they take power. So, since 1991, the United States has vigorously promoted pipelines west from Azerbaijan to the Caspian Sea, and two are now open for oil and for gas. They bypass Russia and Iran, and that's the big idea. They pass through Georgia, and that makes Georgia a transit country, an energy bridge like proposed for Afghanistan. Pipeline politics surfaced during the Georgia conflict. Mr. Cheney visited Azerbaijan and Georgia this month. His talks were in part said to be about pipeline security. The oil pipeline there in black curves down through Turkey to the Mediterranean instead of taking the shortcut to the Black Sea. Again, that's the idea, to avoid the Black Sea. The gas pipeline, shown in green, takes the same route as far as central Turkey, and there it joins the Turkish gas grid. It was extended last year to Greece, which is interesting. It's a symbol or a link of friendship between two ancient enemies.
This is the Local Brown Bagger, heard every Tuesday at 12 noon on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, B.C. Today, you are listening to a speech by John Foster, an international energy economist, on Afghanistan and the Central Asian energy game. This was a speech given at the Maritime Labor Center September 16th. The speaker documents the present-day rivalry among the big powers, who are the major players in the quest to control Central Asia's energy resources. He notes that the recent invasion of Georgia by Russia was met with opposition by the U.S., who were anxious to bolster the Georgian government, events which highlighted the crucial role that the struggle for control of gas pipelines is playing in that country.
Again, our friend Samuel Bodman, the U.S. Energy Secretary, was there at the ribbon cutting. He took a great interest in the matter, and he flew there all the way from Turkmenistan. And there's more. The Russians planned the South Stream line, shown in blue, under the Black Sea to Bulgaria, and thence to Italy and Austria, the divides. Mr. Cheney also visited Italy this month, and you have to wonder why. The South Stream line is a rival to the European Union's line. That's a plan called Nabucco, which means Nebuchadnezzar, shown in red. That would supply gas via Turkey. And the jockeying among countries, therefore, is immense. And the game continues. Washington is planning for new oil and gas pipelines that would link Central Asia under the Caspian Sea to Azerbaijan, and the pipelines from there to Turkey, and hence thence to Europe. But the Russians have been resistant. The Americans won't take no for an answer. Top-level US officials have visited the Turkmen president numerous times this year. One frequent visitor is a man called Stephen Mann. And he's the US coordinator for Eurasian Energy Diplomacy. I don't think Ottawa's got one of those. The president of Turkmenistan went to the NATO summit this April in Bucharest. He talked with President Karzai about the TAPI project, and he met with Mr. Bush to discuss Turkmenistan's gas export policy. The Turkmen president has reiterated his commitment to multiple routes for export of gas in all four directions, north, south, east, and west. And these would all be multi-billion dollar projects extending thousands of kilometers. This does raise the question, are the Turkmen gas reserves big enough to supply the pipelines, the pipeline planned through Afghanistan as well as the other routes? Turkmenistan says yes, and has promised an independent study to certify the reserves. I suspect shivers went down his spine after Georgia. So there we are. The great game is a serious competition for the energy resources of Central Asia. It's a ruthless game. It's about power. Control of energy brings wealth and power in the region and globally. Now let's look at the big picture in the Middle East. There, the West has already achieved dominance, except over Iran. And the consolidation of control and power in the Middle East gives insight into what's happening in Central Asia. The United States has acknowledged its vital interest in the Middle East since the 1940s. The British have done so since before World War I. But the Bush administration put a new twist on the game. It pushed for global domination through overwhelming unilateral power. It sought to reshape the Middle East by force. We all know that. We're witnessing the results. And in all that, I'm reminded of an experience I had myself in Madison, which I think will make my point. It's our oil. When I was visiting Wisconsin 3 years ago, I met a young Bush supporter. I found it quite fascinating to do that. And that's him there on the left. And he asked me what I thought of Venezuela's President Chavez. As you know, Venezuela is another oil-exporting country. At that time, this young man was dating my stepdaughter. I had been warned not to discuss politics with him, so I turned the question round, and I said, "What do you think?" And his reply astonished me. He said, "We can't have Chavez in charge of our oil, our oil." I realized I was in dangerous territory. I had visited the place, but I couldn't resist a comment. I replied, "The Venezuelans might feel it's their oil." And I then quickly changed the subject. I do understand I don't have to meet him again. This US concern for our oil applies in Central Asia and the Caspian Sea as well. They're at the northern end of the so-called oil corridor. All those black spots are giant oil and gas reservoirs. Each one represents a fortune to companies and countries. And the corridor runs south to north from the Gulf States through Iraq and Iran to the Caspian Sea. US Central Command covers the entire oil corridor. The Middle East accounts for 60% of the world's proven oil reserves and 40% of its gas. It is of vital importance. Now, look at the right-hand side of the pie chart. This shows that Saudi Arabia by itself accounts for 20% of the world's oil reserves, and they're shown in blue. The other Gulf states account for another 20%, and they're shown in green. And they're Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, United Arab Emirates. And at the bottom of the chart, Iraq in light blue accounts for another 10%. So that suggests that the US military umbrella dominates the whole right-hand side of the chart, ensuring a measure of control over more than 50% of the world's oil reserves. And Iran in yellow has a further 10% of those reserves. I'd like to say a few words about Iraq's oil. It's common knowledge that Dick Cheney is interested in oil. He formed an energy task force when, in 2001, just 2 weeks after coming to power. Its deliberations were never disclosed. Only a few maps and an anodyne report came out. And one of the maps is shown here on the screen. It's a map of Iraq's oil infrastructure. Cheney didn't want the public to see this. I can't think why. Its release required a court order, appealed right up to the US Supreme Court. I could have drawn the map myself, more or less. The meetings and the map's preparation took place well before 9/11. Let me tell you about Iraq's draft oil law. They have a draft oil law. And it's easy to understand why an oil law is fundamental for Iraq. Oil is the main driver of its economy. But the draft oil law has a long history in the United States and a short one in Iraq. Work started at the State Department in 2002. The law was reviewed in 2006 by companies, IMF and the World Bank. And only last year did a draft of this law reach the Iraqi cabinet and then parliament there. And the Iraqis are told they have to pass this law. And now it appears the parliament is stalling. Parliaments are quite good at that. And I can understand why. It's a made in USA law. And it would open the door to foreign oil companies and allow them exceptionally favorable terms. In the interim, the Iraq government is offering short-term service contracts, as without profit, to develop the largest oil fields. And it announced negotiations this summer with ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, Chevron, and Total. And these are the same companies that were in Iraq prior to 1972. What a coincidence, when Iraq nationalized the oil industry. The announcement caused quite a hullabaloo in Iraq. Even our press noticed it. And since then, the government has signed a deal with the Chinese to develop an oil field. It signed a huge deal with Shell to develop natural gas. That was this month. But it's cancelled the service contracts. That was too much for them to swallow. So perhaps there's more democracy in Iraq than we think. Now, the White House has scoffed at any suggestion the US occupation is about oil. Perish the thought. But Washington insiders now do admit that Iraq is largely about oil. And McCain and Obama would keep non-combat troops there indefinitely. In fact, what they say is they take combat troops out, but they didn't talk about the non-combat troops. And what do Iraqis think was the reason for the war? 2006 poll found that 75% of Iraqis think one of the major reasons for the war was to control Iraq's oil. Now I'd like to just think about the same time about Iran and its oil and gas. Iran is a regional player in the new great game, a place of enormous strategic importance. Iran shares the Persian Gulf with the seven Gulf states, all oil-producing countries. And Iran faces the strategic Strait of Hormuz, and that's the narrow waterway from the Persian Gulf to the Indian Ocean through which 20% of the world's oil production flows every day. And Iran's oil reserves are the third largest worldwide. Iran is rich in natural gas too, the second largest in the world. And where are Iran's oil and gas reserves? Some are in the Persian Gulf, heavily patrolled by the US Navy. But 90% of these reserves lie across the river from Iraq. Think of the Fraser River here, and you're just looking the other side of it. Saddam Hussein crossed the river in the 8-year war,
and tried to seize Iran's oil. He destroyed the Abadan refinery, once the largest of the world. I once visited that refinery. I looked across the river at Iraq. It made me think, could an attack happen again? Iran sees itself encircled, and it is. The flags on the map approximate the location of US bases around Iran. And it's another flashpoint, as we know, among the great powers, and it's a whole story in itself. But Iranians remember that the US interfered for regime change once before. They had a democracy in 1952, and that government nationalized the oil industry, and that was the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company that then became BP. I got my first job after that with BP when they retired these other people. Foreign companies blackballed Iran, and no oil flowed for 18 months. Then the CIA engineered a coup in 1953. A foreign oil consortium came in, and oil flowed again. In 1979, come the Iranian Revolution, the foreign oil companies were thrown out. But since then, US oil firms have remained out of Iraq. That's about Iran, that's about 30 years. Iran, however, reopened the door to foreign investors after its crippling war with Iraq. Europeans and Asian companies signed huge contracts, but the White House blocked American companies from Iran. So, in our newspapers, public discussion focuses on nuclear power, but there's much more at stake. I'd like now to come to my fourth point, which is to look at Canada, Afghanistan, and the energy connection. Here's Canada's official objective for our mission in Afghanistan. But we've heard a lot of other reasons, such as liberating women, educating girls, keeping NATO from failing. There's a whole litany of them. And public relations efforts to convince Canadians to stay in Afghanistan are enormous. The emphasis is on development. It sells well in Canada. My brother in England says it's about poppies. Our friends in the States say it's about terror. So downplayed are violence and US involvement. Energy issues are avoided altogether. I've heard talking heads on television say, there's no pipeline. And that's literally true. But companies follow what's going on, and they come out of the woodwork ready for action once the enabling environment is in place. And that was my experience with a similar project in Latin America. I've also heard talking heads say, it's not about oil. Watch that weasel word. As regards Afghanistan, again, it's literally true because it's about natural gas. The debate in Parliament on extending the mission to 2011 focused on how many troops and how long they should stay there. Details rather than the big picture. It ignored regional geopolitics and energy issues. The decision to extend the mission was reached hot on the heels of the Manley panel report, which came out this January, right? And that report focused on four military options. But it gave little attention to a political settlement, which is how most wars finish. It treated Afghanistan as an island. It ignored Central Asia, regional geopolitics, and energy issues. And why? I do know that at least one submission brought these matters to the panel's attention because I wrote it. Yet, the US clearly asserts the geopolitical importance of Central Asia. There's testimony to the US Congress on screen, making it clear that Central Asia is important to the long-term stability of Afghanistan. The US's ambitious policy objectives in the region involve energy, and the US is pushing for multiple oil and gas export routes. Steve Levine, who's a very interesting senior US journalist, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, took part in a Council on Foreign Relations panel this last year. What he said was, US policy is pipeline driven within a strategy to make this area a pro-Western swath of territory between Russia and Iran. Everything else, he says, is really window dressing. How does all this rivalry in Central Asia affect us here in Canada? as you know, thanks to the CCPA. I wrote a report this June on Afghanistan and pipeline politics. Some of you have copies of it. Otherwise, you can download it from their website. Afterwards, the fallout time, that was in June, journalists asked government ministers in Ottawa a question. Are Canadian forces in Kandahar to defend a pipeline? And the answer was always no comment. In July, Peter McKay was asked the same question on a Halifax talk show, and his reply was, not specifically. And where does that leave us? I was on that talk show the day before. I do hope that inspired the interrogator. So there we are. US strategic thinking is to get other NATO countries involved in guarding oil and gas supplies worldwide. It raises the question, does Canada want NATO to be a worldwide energy protection service? NATO proposals could have enormous consequences, drawing us into long-term military commitments relating to energy, war without end. And I find this troublesome. Canada would be drawn into America's wars automatically through NATO and without say. And what does that mean for sovereignty? And what do bigger and bigger military budgets mean for Canadian health care and other needs? Things we need to think about. And Canada's international reputation is at stake too. We know what's happened to America's reputation in the past 8 years. It's in tatters. And international means more than we might hear from the cabinet, than pleasing the US or NATO. It encompasses the world. And that means a host of other countries, China, India, Russia, Latin America. So Canada faces several challenges. This is my wind-up. The rivalry for energy resources is a power game. And we're already playing. Are we a tribute state, or can we shape our own destiny? We're on course to participate in the militarization of energy through NATO. Have we assessed the consequences? I believe, personally, that militarizing energy is a long-term recipe for disaster. That cooperation works, and that in promoting cooperation, diplomacy is highly important. And so is a foreign policy that respects other nations. The Cold War is over, and let it remain so. So that's my fourth point. There's an energy connection in Afghanistan, a proposed pipeline for a troubled land. And there are energy challenges for Canada that deserve public debate in this election. There are my four points again. I won't read them aloud. And there's the website where the CCPA report can be downloaded. And I thank you very much for listening so patiently to what I had to say.
This is the Local Brown Bagger, heard every Tuesday at 12 noon on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Today, you are listening to a speech by John Foster, international energy economist, on Afghanistan and the Central Asia Energy Game. Following his speech, Mr. Foster answered questions from the audience.
Kretchen led a trade mission, and some contracts were signed with, I believe it was Alberta firms, to do infrastructure contract work there. I'm wondering, first of all, how significant Canada's role is as a direct economic participant in Turkmenistan, and secondarily, what has Harper been doing in that? Like, has Harper continued the initiatives that Kretchen took, or, you know, is this just a minor matter that fell away after Kretchen left office?
If I could try it in a nutshell, the question relates to Canadian capability. To what extent is the Harper government following up on the previous Kretchen, I guess Martin government, in promoting Canadian interests, and how strong are they? A very difficult question, isn't it? Because we don't know too much. What I would say is that Canadian oil and gas capability in Alberta, the other provinces, including BC, is formidable. It's strong. And so, yes, of course, oil and gas companies are following what's going on. They aren't going to talk about it. There was an interesting interview, I might say, since it was on public record, in the Georgia Strait this July, where the LPG company, Canadian, that has a contract to build, has done that, is maintaining an LPG recovery plant in Turkmenistan, is certainly interested in the implications for investment in exports to the south. The Canadian interests are certainly being promoted through the Canadian Executive Director's Office of the Asian Development Bank. That's what it's there to do. And Mr. Chretien continues to support Canadian companies, in particular one which is named and fingered in the report we have, which is Buried Hill Energy. It's based in Cyprus, a Canadian mining company, but major head office is really in, operational office is really in Calgary. And Mr. Creighton has been working overtime on that. I cannot say at all. I don't know about the Harper government. I do know, of course, there are three cabinet ministers from Calgary.
Two of the pipeline proposals go through both Pakistan and India. How does the regional power struggle there affect the prospects of those?
Well, again, that's a good question. The line from Iran through Pakistan into India that has been proposed by the initials of those three countries, IPI, is called also the peace pipeline. The idea being that if it does go ahead, it by definition forces these countries to behave. India is very interested in taking gas down that particular pipeline. What is insisting right now, and one of the sticking points in the negotiations, is that ownership of that gas that goes into India remain Iranian gas throughout its transit through Pakistan to the Indian border. The idea being to make sure that Iran feels a bit of pain if, from India's point of view, Pakistan were to play up. As regards the line through the Tapi line, I've been asked which line is likely to happen. India would say they would like both. The appetite for gas is terrifically great, and of course both pipelines have got their pluses and they've got their cons. Again, if I could do in a nutshell paraphrase the question of who's going to build the pipelines, the major engineering construction companies stand to gain. What do we know about that? Of course, the answer is right now we don't know much about that. But to the extent that the Tapi line, the one through Afghanistan, would have funding in it from the Asian Development Bank, well then that would require that the bidding would go out to international competitive bidding to the extent that the that bank finance it. In the case of the IPI, each of the three countries, national oil companies, would be responsible for the procurement for their section of pipe, and the idea for that is that both Pakistan and India will be protected from companies being debarred from doing business with the United States by having done business with Iran. But yes, of course, the business is huge, but I don't know more.
There are some NATO countries that have been very reluctant to go to southern Afghanistan, most notably Germany, and a short while ago, Germany opposed the acceptance of Georgia within NATO, which I suspect has something to do with gas as well. I'm wondering, within the dynamic of NATO, whether you see any potential for Canada finding new allies that may be opposed to the U.S. agenda that you've described.
That's a splendid question. I think it's a statement in its own right, which I would find it hard to add. It's very clear, and I suppose a fast thing to say, that the United States, of course, is pressing for Georgia to join NATO, as it's pressing for Ukraine to join NATO. And the Western European countries, other than Britain, have been, I'm not sure where they stand, have been opposing the membership of those two countries as being an extremely dangerous thing from the point of view of relationships with Russia and the dangers of being sucked into a war with Russia, as we could see could have happened in the case of Georgia. I see the U.S. continues to press for the membership of those two countries into Russia. I think also that France and Germany, particularly Germany, we hear an awful lot of stuff, I hope I'm not getting away from your point, about stepping up to the plate, this kind of stuff, and these terrible Central Europeans not pulling their weight in NATO and doing the good fighting down there. From their point of view, this is a kind of an English-speaking war down there, of which they want nothing. My view, I've tried not to talk about war and fighting in this. This is I paint myself as a simple energy economist telling that tale. But in my view, you can't build pipelines, if it's a good thing economically to do, by bombing people, by taking away the young men to camps to be seen or not seen again. It doesn't work, and in all my experience of making projects, I would never think of a conditionality. I've made a lot of projects, but I would never have a conditionality that would require a foreign occupying army to impose it. You can't do development at the end of a gun. It's just stupid.
This game, or pipeline, or makes money, who can have the most person, most money, or most pipeline? Canada or state? Maybe state say, okay, thank you, you supporting me, you lose your people, and then now, bye-bye, I can have everything, you don't have anything, but I don't know, I'm afraid about this. I would like to know who can have a big, personally, okay, for example, I lose more people, I pay more price. We pay more price about this game. This not a good game.
No, I think that's the most interesting statement you've made. And,
thank you.
I have nothing to add to it, and I thank you very much.
Thank you
for your understandings.
So, what would you like to see the peace movement do in light of this? Here, the labor council's involved with BC Labor Against War. We have a local anti-war coalition, StopWar.ca, and also the World Peace Forum involved in these issues. So what role would you see the peace movement playing?
Well, from my point of view, I presented, if you like, the what I understand to be the scene, which is what I've been telling you. And I would like to see that this whole regional setting of Afghanistan enter into the electoral debate. That I would like to see. But at that point, I have no skill or knowledge of how to do that. And it's like throwing a stone into the pond and seeing who's going to enjoy the ripples.
You have been listening to The Local Brown Bagger, heard every Tuesday at 12 noon on CFRO, 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Co-op Radio. On today's Brown Bagger, you've heard a speech by energy economist John Foster, given at the Maritime Labor Center on September 16, 2008. It was sponsored by the Vancouver and District Labor Council. The speech, entitled Afghanistan and the Central Asian Energy Game, outlines the struggle among major imperialist powers for control of the energy resources in Central Asia. It indicates why Canada's military is in Afghanistan at the present time. The speech was based on a research paper by John Foster, published by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives in June of 2008. You can download this paper entitled Pipeline in a Troubled Land from the CCPA website. If you would like a copy of today's Brown Bagger show, you can access it at www.ecoshock.net/brownbagger. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
Thank you.